The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 21 from the Book of Serenity. Yunyan sweeps the ground. As Yunyan was sweeping the ground, Dawu said, "Too busy." Yunyan said, "You should know there's one who isn't busy." Dawu said, "If so, then there's a second moon." Yunyan held up the broom and said, "Which moon is this?" So we've heard two wonderful talks about this koan already. And as it's been penetrating the sesshin and penetrating me, I always wonder what's going to come out of my mouth to say. And last night I was reading Wansong's commentary on this koan. And then I just read it before we got together for the talk to refresh myself, and was struck once again by how Wansong, who is the person who gathered together the remnants of this collection of koans after it had been destroyed, burned in some places. It had originally been put together by Hongjer, who is one of our wonderful Zen ancestors. Hongjer collected the cases and wrote a poem about each one. And then Wansong, who lived a bit later, recollected them and wrote a pointer and commentary, included Hongjer's poem and then a commentary on the poem, and then gathered many other commentaries himself. Wansong took other teachers' historical or semi-historical responses to these koans and put them together in what we now call the Book of Serenity, or the Book of Equanimity, or one of our friends translates it as the Record of Going Easy. So these 100 cases are sometimes repeats of koans that have been worked through in other collections, like in the Gateless Gate, in the Blue Cliff Record. They show up again here in this very Soto collection, a collection that was put together by Soto teachers around the same time that these other collections, Blue Cliff and Gateless Gate, were put together, around the same time that Dogen lived, around the same time that St. Francis lived, and many other amazing people, Rumi, all populating the planet at this time. What an amazing time that was. And only because we have records of things that people said and did from then. But maybe, just maybe, every time is an amazing time. Sometimes things are lost to history. Sometimes they are preserved, as Wansong did here. And I want to read you a little bit of Wansong's commentary, which goes on and on and on. I'm just going to read a few lines from it and then comment on those. So here's what Wansong says about this koan. He says, "Dawu bore down on Yunyan. As it is said," and then he quotes from somewhere else, "without upset, there is no solution. Without struggle, there is no expression." I'll just repeat that quote. "Without upset, there is no solution. Without struggle, there is no expression." And Wansong goes on and says, "Here, as Yunyan was sweeping the ground, Dawu casually tested him. Yunyan said, 'You should know there is one who isn't busy.'" And Wansong goes on and says, "Good people, as you eat, boil tea, sew, and sweep, you should recognize the one not busy. Then you will realize the union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. In the Dongshan progression, this is called simultaneous inclusion, naturally, not wasting any time." So a few things about this really, to me, very direct and clear pointer to what the koan's about. And we've heard from Alan Roche and Alan Sensei and David Roche about these things and the koan itself. But this is one song now, a third teacher commenting. And what is he saying to us? He says, Dawu bore down on Yunyan. In the record, Yunyan is the older practitioner, and Dawu is the younger one. As Alan was saying, Yunyan practiced for 20 years with the great teacher Baijiang, and Dawu just a few years. So he was considered the younger practitioner, the younger brother. They were brother monks, as all of us are sisters and brothers here together in this family that we call Sangha, community. We've certainly made a community, haven't we, over just less than 2 days. We've come together as one body, walking together as one body, eating, sleeping, sharing the sitting practice, the formal practice of Zazen, and the informal practice, all the in-between times, and especially maybe in relationship to this koan, Samu, the caretaking, the being a caretaker, as Alan quoted Gary Snyder saying, clean the temple, come forward and care for every single opportunity that's presented to us. Whatever it is, this requires our attention, our clarity as best we can be clear when we're tired and confused, our meeting, our intimacy with the thing right here. Intimacy meaning in the, maybe an older sense of the word intimacy, not necessarily a sexual intimacy, but a connectedness. Not seeing separations, not putting everything into categories of right and wrong, this and that, you and me. There's just this, now arising as Melissa giving a talk and you're listening to it and here we are together. The sound reaches your ears. Maybe there's no comprehension at all. Maybe something goes right into your heart or into your belly. Who knows? It doesn't matter. Just sounds on the air produced in my vocal cords. Where are they coming from? Where does this this not being busy, which this whole koan points to, this not making more of an effort than is required, where does this come from? It's the great mystery. Who is speaking? Who is hearing? We ask, and we actually have koans that ask those very questions. Who is the one right here, listening or not listening, comprehending or not comprehending? It doesn't make any difference. What else would we do with our time? What else would we do with our lives? So much to do, so busy. I don't know about you, but I have a to-do list. We've talked about it recently in some Dharma talks. This seems to be an ongoing theme. And I have a calendar. I actually keep a paper calendar. And in my calendar, I write down what I'm supposed to do over the next day, week, month, even years in some cases. I had to buy a paper 2027 calendar because I have some doctor and dentist appointments and I didn't want to lose track of them. Those of you who use technology know that you can go forward in time on your phone or your iPad or your computer with some ease. Just type it in, 2027, January 3rd, doctor's appointment, 10 o'clock, and you can even set it in a different color, and you can set a something to remind you to do it. So this is an interesting thing that we do as human beings. We're planning animals, and we think we know what's going to happen in the future, or just today, or just in the next moment. Well, we don't really know. It's a kind of wonderful game we all play. My calendar, let me calendar with you, let me plan this future with you. Let's meet at 10 o'clock in a month, in a year. There's a wonderful book that was written sometime, I think, in the 1950s, and the title of it was Sunday After the War. And it was the main plot point was that we're in the middle of this terrible experience, which happened to be World War II, but let's meet at this cafe Sunday after the war. No specific fixed time, but some future some future orientation, some future way of engaging with the shared fantasy of time and space. And so sometimes when I look at my calendar or I look at my to-do list, anxiety starts arising. I think, oh no, I'm teaching a sesshin this weekend, and then I'm going to babysit for 2 days, and then David's going away to Vermont for 2 days. When am I going to do the stuff on my to-do list? It's like, and then in the moment of actually doing these things, not the planning mind, which gets anxious and worried, and time seems to collapse and get very, very small. Life is actually kind of spacious. This is an idea I carry around, a contracted idea about time, about the future. We do this about the past as well. There are billions and trillions and quadrillions of moments in our past. We only remember a few of them, and we string them together, and we tell the story of our life, the self-affirming narrative. It's amazing, and we ignore almost everything else. As we get older, and there are a number of us in this room who are proving that you can get older and still practice Zen, it's wonderful. We start to forget things. Even if we don't have dementia, the mind stops retaining certain things, names and places and memories, I've been noticing. And I can worry about this, but I realized the other day that I made up a story about myself when I went into menopause about 25 years ago. It's a natural thing that women's brains change at that time, and we start to become forgetful, and we think, oh no, oh no. But it's actually been so long ago, and I'm not that way anymore. I have a pretty good memory. I don't remember everything. But if I compare my memory now to my story of my memory, that's where the great error comes in. I don't really know how my memory was 25 years ago. I seem to remember that it was getting bad, but now it's great. I remember names and places and people and faces. Who knows how that will unfold as the future goes? I could fear dementia. I could think, oh no, it happened before, it's going to happen again. But the reality is, even in aging, we don't know what the next moment will bring. Sometimes our bodies seem to be breaking down, and sometimes they revive themselves. Cells divide and turn into healthy parts of our body. It's a great mystery. How does it work? We don't know. But to expect a certain narrative of the future and to expect a certain narrative of the past makes us feel busy or regretful. Busy as the future unfolds in its fantasy realm, and regretful as the past keeps reiterating itself in our mind. To know that there's just this, but this includes all of these things, is what Dogen meant by being time, uji. We think of time as a linear progression from past to present to future, and so the future can scare us. We all know that we're going to leave sesshin someday. If you don't know that, I hope it's not news to you, but I'm happy to tell you right now that that will happen, probably if you survive to the end of sesshin. And who knows, we haven't had anybody die at sesshin yet, but it's certainly possible. And I remember this one Chinese teacher who at the end of every sesshin would congratulate everybody for not dying. And yeah, that is quite a thing. Still alive, like this. Not the person we were on Friday night, and not the person we will be tonight or tomorrow. We don't know how things will unfold. The calendars do not tell the whole story. We were saying in the officers' meeting, we have what's called an officer's manual. And it seems to say everything that's going to happen, like my calendar. But we realize that it is not telling the truth. Musicians know that there are score sheets. If you play classical music or sing classical music, they're pretty close to what the actual production of the sound is. If you're a jazz musician, not at all. There's what's called a lead sheet that just has the melody and the chords. And what comes through that is always a surprise, always. And even for classical musicians, it's still a surprise. Every performance unique, every moment of creativity different. Now this, informed by everything that's ever happened. So many things that we can't even look to one thing that caused this next thing to happen. And yet, we get caught. We all do. I'm so busy. You can't believe what I'm going to have to do next week or next month or next year. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to handle it. And yet, if we really are honest with ourselves, we always handle it. Maybe we handle it by falling apart and falling into a heap of sobbing on the floor. But that's a way of handling it. Maybe we get enraged because things aren't happening the way we want them to be. And that's a way of handling it. And the surprise of life, of not knowing who will be with us as time moves on and who will not be with us. This group of people right now is completely unique. We may never again be together in this way. There may be some of us missing and some new people, always changing, always shifting. This is how time seems to truly unfold, in mystery, in surprise. And our job is to be curious about this, not intellectually curious, but viscerally curious, gut-brain curious. What is this now? What is this? Right this moment, who is the one who is busy? Dao Wu says, too busy. And Yun Yan says, you should know there is one who isn't busy. Wan Song says, good people, as you eat, boil tea, sew, and sweep, you should recognize the one not busy. Right now, things have been simplified, as we've been saying. And some of us who are officers holding the retreat together, it's a little more complicated, but still so much simpler than our daily life. But the warning here and the teaching is pointing to not making a separation between ordinary life and Sashin life, as Wan Song says, mundane reality and enlightened reality. When things are simple and everything comes to us and brightens our hearts and we are awake to the truth of reality, the Dharma, the way things are, when that's happening and there's more opportunity for that to happen at a Sashin just because of the simplified life we're all living. The mundane reality, as Wan Song calls it, is also capable, we are capable of encountering that mundane reality in exactly the same way. If your job is to sweep, and it might be, you might be relating to Yun Yan here because you're sweeping. Sweeping, sweeping, and then the next day, sweeping again. Cleaning the bathroom, cleaning the bath, and the next day, cleaning it again. Cooking and cleaning, and cooking and cleaning, and cooking and cleaning. My daughter gave me a book, I think it was about 20 years ago, when she was learning how to keep a household. And the title of the book is great. It's called Unfuck Your Habitat. You can't look that up online. You have to look up UNFUCK *K, your habitat. But one of the lessons in it, one of the chapters in it, I hadn't read it carefully back when she gave it to me, but I read it recently, a month or so ago, and there's a whole chapter on making your bed. The thing in that particular book is that the first thing you need to do after you get out of bed in the morning and your feet touch the ground and you go to the bathroom and you come back to your bedroom is make your bed. And there's a long chapter about it because the argument against it is, but I'm just going to mess it up again tonight. And kids say this a lot. Why should I do it? Why should I do it? And this is, of course, making that linear understanding of past, present, and future as if there was a line going in that direction. Everything returns to now, to the one, here, here. The birds singing are not thinking, maybe I'll sing this song today, or maybe I'll go and find that worm today. They just do it. And so the teaching in this book is just do it. Start with making your bed. Then things will start to follow. And I'm not sure that's true, but I love the sentiment. It reminds me of a teaching from Robert Aitken about how to keep your practice alive in your daily life, in what Wan Son calls mundane reality. Every moment, be present. When you open your eyes in the morning and you wake up, like that teacher Ruyan who said, "Master, yes, are you awake? Yes." You be that person. You say, "I'm awake." Maybe you come right to your koan, if you have a koan. Maybe you come right to your breath, if your practice is breath. Maybe you come right to full presence, if your practice is just sitting. Full presence, including everything, not confined to some special location or event, right there in the bed, even before you sit up, if you're capable of sitting up. That's kind of a blessing. And then you sit up and your feet, as Robert Aitken said, you feel your feet touching the floor. Just this. And then you come to standing. For some of us, we just jump out of bed. It's kind of great. For others of us, and this has to do with the aging thing too, at least for me, there's a lot of activity that's required to come to standing. It just takes a little bit of extra attention, making sure that we're balanced, that we're moving forward into the bathroom and doing what we need to do there, and on and on and on. Making the bed, making breakfast, taking care. If you join us in sitting in the morning at 7 o'clock, you go to your computer and you turn on your computer and you click the buttons and you go to the website and you go to the link and there it is. Your sangha appears. Wow, it's like magic. All these little moments are the completeness of our life, whether it's mundane reality or enlightened reality. It doesn't make any difference. Because we keep emphasizing not separating them. So he says, good people, as you do all these things, whatever they happen to be doing, he's saying boiling tea, sewing, sweeping, you should recognize the one who's not busy, and then you will realize the union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. Which he refers to as a teaching in what he calls here the Dongshan progression, which is one of the koan collections that we use in Boundless Way. We sometimes call it the five ranks or the five modes of Dongshan. Yunyan was Dongshan's teacher. Dongshan was the great reviver of, and actually creator of Soto Zen in China. And he had a whole bunch of systems, the three thises and the four thats, and one of them was the five ranks, where he talks about how form and emptiness interact with each other, yin and yang, the strong and the weak, the bent and the straight, all the different ways that we separate the world into opposites, and how sometimes one leads and sometimes another leads, and sometimes they come together. And so in the Dongshan progression, as Wan Son calls it, it's simultaneous inclusion. We don't even think about it anymore. It's just all of our life is awakened life. whether we're doing formal practice or, as we call it, informal practice, 100% practicing the great way, not making categories. I'm practicing well, or I'm practicing poorly, or this is much better than that. I like this, I don't like that. Those things happen, they're natural, they're part of an earlier part of the Dongshan progression. But ultimately, it's all this one thing, showing up within the uniqueness of form, within the vastness of shunyata, all of it arising together, and there comes a time when we don't even think about it anymore. This is just life. There are people who do this naturally. I have met them. They do not practice Zen. It's not just animals and birds and trees that practice naturally. There are some human beings who do that. But all of us who are attracted to this practice haven't been able to find a way to do it naturally, or we've lost it. I think babies and small children do it. But then we get trained out of it. We get trained to make categories. They're useful. It's nice to know that this is garbage and that's food. That's really useful. This is water and that's gasoline. Don't drink this one and don't put that one in your car. And it's not but. It's and everything arising together, the whole glorious universe. This is what we realize when we awaken. We awaken to something that's always been here, that we've ignored because we were taught to judge and categorize. We had to learn how to do it, to make decisions, but then we get lost in it. And Zen helps us, those of us who need the help, to stop that business of separating and dividing, to close the gap. As they say, if you've ever been on the London Underground, old trains and gaps sometimes between the train door and the platform, and there are signs everywhere that say, mind the gap. Mind the gap. There is a gap between how the world actually is and what we think the world is. And when that gap gets bigger and bigger and bigger, there's a lot of pain in that. This is a way of minding the gap, not necessarily getting rid of it, might be impossible to get rid of, but really being present to it, to the arising of separation, of judgment, of this is better than that. There's the one who's busy and then the one who's not busy. Really? Really? Are you saying, as Dawu says, that there's a second moon? And of course, Yunyan is not saying that. And to prove it, he holds up the broom. Which moon is that? And I'll just end with one more comment by Wansong on this Dawu saying, if so, then there's a second moon. Wansong says, only two? There's hundreds, thousands, myriads. Life promises us more than we could ever imagine, more than we could ever put in our phone or our planner, more than we can ever write down in an officer's manual or a music score. Discovering the truth of life in each moment, the way things come together and come apart. This is our responsibility as Zen practitioners. As Yunyan was sweeping the ground, Dawu said, too busy. Yunyan said, you should know there's one who isn't busy. Dawu said, if so, then there's a second moon. Yunyan held up the broom and said, which moon is this? Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and we'll make our oval. and have our Dharma dialogue. Yes, Deb.
Thank you, Melissa. I love this line about the broom and the moon, because usually you think the moon is this heavenly body, this special thing, and it's the broom too. It's when I'm chopping the celery, it's the knife and the celery. And just doing that, there's something about doing each thing separately. Because at home, I find I'm, you know, trying to do 10 things. You know, that's the busyness. And it's lovely to just be with one thing.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the gift of Sesshin, that we kind of do one thing at a time. And of course, that's all we ever do, whatever else our mind is doing. But the gift of narrowing the focus, then there can be some meeting. And it's not actually narrowing the focus, but being here, and we see here includes everything.
It's possible that the focus expands too. I think about times I've cut celery in this space, in this mind space, and suddenly I can hear the chop, 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 and the crispness of the cut, and then the color, and the, like it just goes, whoa, there's this big experience. Yeah. Somehow or other, we do get the celery chopped. But just this.
Just beauty.
Which can be, yeah.
And then all those things you chopped up separately go into the same soup.
Yes! And then they go into the same stomach and come out the intestines, hopefully. Yes, Ray.
I initially heard one fellow testing the other. Mm-hmm. And I mean, no, I personally don't like being tested at all. Because the possibility of my being wrong, that there's a correct way and there's an incorrect way, and then I get it wrong. And yet, when a question is asked where any answer is accurate, I mean, I think of, I've been working with Sesshin as a Nichai officer of Samu, and I recognize I need something needs to be done, and I ask him to do it, and it gets done. And there's no correct way or incorrect way of doing anything. And so when the question is asked, you know, it's like a koan. It's like there's no correct answer. You're not being tested. Or whatever the other fellow said was it. And that's the way life seems to be unfolding. It's like being met with whatever needs to be done. And we do it, and either reveals itself to us its essential nature, or it's just that showing up, and that's it, and no difference. So it's all koan, if you will.
Yes, and if the pieces of celery are 6 inches long in the soup, we're going to have trouble putting it into our bowl. And so appreciating no right or wrong, but then we can be present and notice,
right.
Oh, when I do this, that happens.
Yes.
And so I love this freedom of both and, because mm-hmm. it's not about there's only one way, there are a million ways. And some maybe lead to outcomes that we like more, and we can notice that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's different than a moral judgment. Am I a good person?
Right.
That's like, oh, I do this and this happens, and bringing awareness to that, not as, oh, I'm such a terrible person. Why did I do 6-inch pieces again? Steve's going to be mad at me. And, right, but just noticing.
You know, and this thing that leads to outcomes, here you are looking around the temple, there's so many ways to do things, but if somebody piled up all the toilet paper in the shower, that would not serve. That's a great example of it, right? I looked to David after he spoke, because all I wanted to say to you was wrong. No, you're only seeing a small part of this whole thing. But of course, it would have been a little jokey. These two guys have lived together for years. They practice together. And that's the spirit of koan. It's not that whatever you say in response to a koan is correct. That's not how koans work. It's you're showing your insight when you respond to a koan. You're showing your insight when you come into Doksan and say, I'm noticing that I'm working with my pain like this. Right? So there's no wrong in that sense. And there are things we want to help out with. Here's a way to work with pain that seems to have more easeful outcomes than other ways, right? So this is they are testing each other, and they're kidding around, right? I think Alan said that last night in his talk. They're joking, they're playing. It's play. You know, my mother used to say when I would get upset about something, she would say, "Life is real, life is earnest," and then we would all laugh. Right? It's not. And it is. Sometimes it is. People are dying, and people are getting, attacked, and people are getting terrible diagnoses, and that's all true. But could we meet those things in the same way as we meet the cutting of the celery? You know, can we feel the pain in our hearts when we feel pain in our hearts? Can we meet the situation? Not about right or wrong or good or bad. But whatever arises is this. And then sometimes people can help us, steer us towards something that's more beneficial. Yeah. Thank you so much. Steve, all right, your hand was up before.
You're getting celery in the soup.
And there you have it. Yes, Anne.
But there are people I have found in Zen where you have to do the form exactly right. And if you do it that way, it's wrong. You get corrected for it. And it doesn't, in some ways, for the universe, it doesn't make a difference. It's like you're honoring the form by doing it in a very particular way, even though ultimately it doesn't matter.
Yeah, like cutting the celery. Six inches versus...
There's some things that don't matter.
What's that?
But that does matter. It doesn't fit in your bowl, right?
But that's the thing about the forms, Anne. We have to feel that they matter. We have to start to see that when everybody's turning to the left and you turn to the right, that actually has an outcome. That's what we have to see. These forms are all made up. They're really made up. And some people, you're right, are very strict about them. And I think if you go to a lot of Zen groups, you'll find places that don't really care about forms at all. And you find other places where they just yell constantly. I've been to both kinds of places. We're trying to do the middle way here. But all of them are coming from the same place. What's the most important thing? I know what it is to me. I know what appears to facilitate awakening. And when we're not thinking anymore about where we turn or what we do with our eyes or any of that, when we're just doing it, that does have an impact, a really powerful impact. And I think we felt it the first night. Boom, those bells rang, that was it. That's so amazing. And it's not for everybody. That's why there's so many different kinds of Zen groups and Buddhist groups. And religious groups, and non-religious groups. And yeah, you can do a lot of stuff with your life.
I think it's important to acknowledge, this goes back to Ray's point, that there's no one right way to do most things. But that doesn't mean that there aren't some really wrong ways to do some things. You know, and that's something I found as a classroom teacher. There's no one right answer, but there are some wrong ones, and you're not doing your students a favor if you indulge them in answers that take them just way out in left field, far, far from where they would want to be in terms of whatever you're trying to teach them. And so the forms that we've come up with are not the only right forms, not at all. But once we have them, then it's right to follow them. And it's wrong, as Melissa was saying, to turn left when everybody else is turning right, to sit down when everybody else is standing up. Then we no longer function as a Sangha, as that one body.
And how do we follow these patterns without beating ourselves up? You know, there's a lot of opportunity on Sesshin to be criticized. Mm-hmm. Most of us are not criticized as much, I hope, in daily life as you are here. I had a rowing coach when I used to row a little bit, and he videotaped me, and we were going up to the boathouse, we were going to watch it, and I said, well, I'm a little nervous. And he said, oh, don't be nervous. I'm not judging you, I'm just criticizing you. I said, oh, thanks. but of course we have defensive, you know, how dare you say that? And because the arbitrary nature of it, we get to see that reactivity, and then we get to dance together in some way. This arbitrary dance, but this traditional dance, and get to move together and feel the beauty of joining in together.
Dave, did you have your hand?
Yeah, I was just gonna, I just got to picking up this, what David Roshi was saying about this difference between criticizing and judging, that we can criticize and be criticized without the judgment. Mm-hmm. And an example in my own life of this is that I have a lot of criticism and taste in what music I'm listening to. And I really don't like certain types of music, like, for example, Taylor Swift. I really hate it. Really, just, it makes my whole body feel like it's going
to... Sorry.
But,
we didn't hear that, but what was it?
She said, just shake it off.
Just shake it off.
Like, this is bad, all these people, like, they don't get it. That's easy.
Yes.
It's true.
A lot of people.
I do that a lot. And my wife reminds me when I did it. But I think the direction of this is that this thought is, all these people go to this and see this, and they dance, and they laugh, and they have fun, and they're excited. And there's thousands and thousands of them.
And you hate it.
And no, I do, but I ask this question, like, what am I missing here? What is it like for them? What is, it's this difference. It's like, in the celery thing, it's like, okay, nobody can eat a big piece of celery. But in this one, it's like, some people like the big celery, and some people don't. so I think this is just... see that other people do.
Yeah.
And can we know, oh, I can't see this, but someone else is. Mm-hmm. And kind of get some joy from that, even though we don't get...
I think it's possible. And I have a Taylor Swift story. Because I felt the same about Taylor Swift for many years. Just like flat out, don't get it. And... people tried to explain it to me, and I, nope, I don't like it musically, I don't like the whole tent, blah, blah, blah. And then one day I heard a song on the radio that was just beautiful, like really wonderful lyrics and melody, and the person singing it had this gorgeous voice. And I think I was with my daughter, and I said, who's that? And she said, that's Taylor Swift, Mom. And it was suddenly like, oh, like the... I couldn't have the judgments because I didn't know. I was approaching something with ignorance. And there's something that Zen encourages around that too. You know, just can you meet situations that are normally I don't know, aversive, that we're aversive to, with sort of a clearness and a curiosity, what is this? Mm-hmm. Instead of, oh yeah, those people, which we do all the time, right? And we can't help it. So that's what I'm trying to say here is that I think you could decide to try to bring Swifties into your life. And maybe not. Maybe let yourself be with the aversion more completely. Like really, really get to know the aversion. It's a certain kind of pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it feels separating. And
yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's where I'm coming from.
Well, and I think, too, how to own our own world. Not everyone loves to dig in the dirt, you know, and so we don't have to have an argument, should you dig in the dirt or not? You know, clearly someone else should be doing something else. It'd be too crowded out there in the garden if everyone... joined. So how to really treasure and notice what it is that when I do it, I come alive. What's the music that I can listen to? What's the activity that nourishes me? And then I get to turn toward that, and other people don't have to. I don't have to convince other people. It's not, yeah, I think it's the many moons, mm-hmm. not just one moon. 1,000 moons. And so I hear you kind of appreciating, well, I can't see that one, but it must be pretty beautiful for you, isn't it? Right? Yeah.
Thank you. Well.
I just wanted to say about that last thing that one of the things that's sometimes a little confusing for me, but I actually really love is that, you know, at the end of Sesshin, we always get instructions, including, you know, the point that if people ask you how it was, they're not really interested. And it's not, you don't need to, like, tell them lots of things about it or try to say, oh, you gotta come next time. And, it, you know, that sort of letting, you know, if people need it, they'll come, right? And it's not, you know, it's really not for everybody what we do. And I love that fact, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, sometimes it's a little, you sort of wish that you could, you know, but it's so obviously true that this is really not for anybody, you know.
Yeah.
And I appreciate being reminded of that when you leave here. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sometimes the surprise is that anybody's here at all. And yet for those of us that works for,
yeah,
it just works so well. Yeah, and I'm thinking about, you know, there are people here who have been with other groups, mm-hmm. that didn't work, and they're here. And then there are people that were here that are with other groups now. And so there's kind of some sorting out over the years. And it's so important that we not think that we should be here for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like David's, you know, in the garden. We couldn't get 1 million people in here.
Mm-hmm.
Great that we've got this group that we have, and it doesn't really have to be bigger.
Well, we could, you know, if there were 1 million people who just decided, this is it for me, I love Boundless Ways End, this is really the thing, then hopefully we would raise enough money to build a huge building, single rooms for everybody, like they have up at Insight Meditation Society. But then there would be other things that would be difficult, because I know this. I was just talking to somebody who works there at the Ideal Place. It's right up the road in Barrie, the biggest Vipassana center. And they have all kinds of problems because they have so many people, right? And they're teaching a specific way of being with, of doing meditation is different from ours, and you know it's there's nothing that isn't all mixed up, and I love that too. I mean, I think the people who go to Taylor Swift concerts, there's negatives there too. They get upset with her, and there's all this stuff online, and you can get really sucked into that. There's a way of seeing that every condition is the condition it is. And we're going to participate in this condition or not. Yeah, what?
I just couldn't. So I really loved your talk. And so it reminded me of joy, you know, and
the feeling of joy, not joy.
Yeah, the feeling of joy. And that there is no joy that is more joyful than the joy that comes from waking up to the present moment and what is here. And I don't know if things become simple after that, or, you know, if things are always simple and be complicated, but, you know, but how that, you know, joy of waking up, like even simplicity is so mixed with that, and just it feels, things feel so natural.
And something that's really touching me in what you said is that, you know, you think about the difference between happiness and joy. And joy always involves a kind of pure presence. It always involves a really being there and other things dropping away. For me, and that's how I understand it. So there's that joy waking up, but there's some waking up in all joy as opposed to happiness or pleasure.
And I think there is a fixed idea in popular culture that the kind of waking up we're talking about, this big joy, will then solve all our problems and we won't get tangled up again. Like you were saying in your Dharma talk the other night, talking about legs entangled, quoting a poem, Monte quoted a poem where feet were entangled, legs were entangled, I can't remember. Yeah, anyway, but this entanglement is always here. Even if we become hermits and go out to the thatched roof hermitage, we're still engaged in the world, that we're still interconnected. It's complicated. And I certainly had that delusion when I first started Zen. And I think I was disappointed. and now I'm not disappointed anymore. But every once in a while it comes in, like, oh, wait, maybe there is this way to be permanently joyful. Can you imagine being around a person like that? I mean, I don't know if I could stand it. But there's a kind of joy that's not big that does permeate Zen practice. This nothing better than this. I think, I really do feel that. Yeah, and I know you do too.
And I would say there's a permanent joy, it just doesn't last. And it's wonderful.
Yeah. So maybe that's a good place to end. Thank you, everybody. Now let's reset the Zendo.